Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's EcoLogic. We're going to do something a little bit different today. I'm your host, Ted Flanagan, and I'm going to have a co-host, Russell Sturm, joining me. And together we're going to be interviewing Jesse Moore. He's the CEO of MCOPA. It's an African-based company that provides off-grid distributed solar systems. They've done 3 million, served 3 million customers with their PAYGO financing model. And they have really transformed and made the quality of life for so many people so much better. So really excited to have Russ and Jesse on the podcast today. Hey, welcome to the podcast, Russ and Jesse. So good to meet you. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing great.
Jesse?
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
And Jesse, you're beaming in from Nairobi. You're joining us from Nairobi, Kenya, which I appreciate at the end of your work day. And Russ Sturm is in Bethesda, Maryland. So we've got quite a geographic spread. And Russ, you were gonna give us a little context here about MCOPA. You have introduced me to Jesse. I'm impressed by the company, impressed by what you've accomplished, Jesse. Russ, why don't you take it away for a few minutes and give us some context?
Yeah. So you and I, Ted, had talked about having a conversation where we're able to explore and explain, describe the sort of magical and impressive evolution of an off-grid solar industry over the last 15 years that has emerged to, for the first time, impact a market of 2 billion people on the planet that don't have access to reliable modern energy. And about half those people don't have access to a grid at all, and about the other half are reliant on a grid that may work half the day. And therefore, those two markets, those two groups of humanity either rely on candles and kerosene lights for basic energy services, or and then making their way to a market town to pay a buck for their cell phone charging, or they rely on Satan's revenge, which is the diesel generator, in order to sustain some semblance of a modern life and productivity for their businesses. And so about 2005, I was working at the International Finance Corporation, and we had a long history of trying to figure out how to use financial engineering to enable a $500 or $700 solar home system with a couple of compact fluorescent lights and a car battery and 50-watt, 75-watt panel to be affordable to people that earn less than $5 a day. And any sort of magical financial finagling doesn't allow that to happen. It's just an unaffordable technology. And at that time, I'd been working a lot with the lighting industry and saw LEDs emerging. And at that time, they were fairly expensive and fairly inefficient. And so you'd had a couple of them in an automobile and a couple of them on, you know, phones and laptops were starting to deploy them a bit. And there was potential for the market, and you could see the learning curve and the efficiency gains that were in the future. And I saw that by deploying LEDs in lieu of CFLs in a solar application, you could start to package products at different price points that were sold as consumer products. The simplest version of that is a solar light, which had a small 3-watt panel, some LED, an LED array, and a lithium battery, which was emerging. And as I was seeing this, there was a few entrepreneurs, and they tended to be college students or grad students, that were sort of seeing the same thing. And I thought that it was going to be the big boys, Philips and Osram and GE, these big lighting companies that would say, huh, $30 billion market, Russell Sturm says at the ISC, we can take that thing. And especially if you look at what people, the poorest people in the world are paying, which is the most for the worst. And that never played out. But what did play out was a group of young entrepreneurs that started innovating products, solar lights that were selling $35, then $20, then $15, then $5. And then more sophisticated products had phone charging, It's packaged solar systems that had TV, computer, fans, radios, phone charging, small solar home systems, everything downsized because of more efficient technology, converting a few electrons to useful energy. I encountered Jesse as this industry was starting, and he was working at the association that represented cell phone services, GSMA, in London. And he and I were puzzling over the fact that the infrastructure for cell phones across Africa were, because of the market dynamics to quickly set up cell phone towers, were doing what the quickest, easiest thing to do was, planting a couple diesel generators on a remote cell tower. And we looked at the economics and the long term of this, and we said, well, why not just use PVs and battery storage and design your systems in a more efficient manner so you're not air conditioning them to keep them going? And so Jesse took the lead on IFC trying to support as best we could initiative to transition that industry. The next thing I know, Jesse is popping on my door saying, hey, man, I've got this business model. And those larger systems that cost $150, $200, $250 that have applications to actually light entire homes in multiple rooms and do phone charging and provide fans and TVs. And then, hey, this market is also farmers, so why not do irrigation in other applications with the same system? We think we have a solution as we look at the spread of cellular phones in Africa, where they had leapfrogged wiring up everybody to a home phone. And cell phones were like crack in their spread in the market. And the companies that were selling cell phones and cell phone services positioned themselves to do all sorts of things remotely, including banking services. And I'll use that to turn it over to Jesse. But I just say that Jesse and MCOPA have continued to innovate. They're in a completely different application set for the pay-as-you-go model of financing consumer products. Jesse can tell that story, but he has, because of his adherence to a very strong focus on building MCOPA as a sustainable, profitable company, he's been able to attract commercial financing that's allowed him to innovate and grow. And he's a representative of an industry of entrepreneurs that sees that the only way to really address at scale these fundamental development problems is with commercial markets, with companies that are responsive to customer needs, not responsive to donor biases, able to innovate, drive prices down, continuously provide products that respond to what people need in market. And I think one of your key investors, Jesse, that you may want to talk about is Generation Capital, which is Al Gore's super high performing private equity fund. Jesse.
Yeah. Thanks, Russ, for the context. How amazing. So we're at around the year 2010, Jesse, is that about right? When this all began?
Absolutely. That's right when we started the company and I moved to Kenya. Full time. I've been here a lot before, but 2010 is the inception of the business.
And so tell the story. How did you choose to go to Kenya? How did that come about?
Yeah, great question. So a little bit different to what Russ has been explaining. I come more from a financial services background, particularly in microfinance. So effectively how to do banking with low-income people in a way that's positive for their livelihoods, but also could be a business in its own right, sustainable. I cut my teeth in my 20s with CARE, which is one of the world's largest nonprofit charities doing humanitarian work and development work, and veered towards microfinance and other social business activities while I was there. And then at one point decided I wanted to go get an MBA, partly because it's pretty hard to make money well, you know, with poor people. It's not, there are you know, for better or worse, there are a lot of folks who have needs like Russell outlined. But when you're trying to eke out profit margin in a sustainable way, both for your investors and for the clients, you know, there's not a lot of wiggle room there. So I decided I needed to hone my business training and ended up in Oxford for an MBA, courtesy of the School Foundation, who fund social entrepreneurship. The other thing about me was I had a real interest in mobile telephony and how that was leapfrogging in some of the same ways that Russell's explained renewable energy has and can continue to leapfrog over no grid, is you can kind of go from, you know, candles to LED lights and modernity. In a similar way, cell phones have gone from, you know, places where there's zero connectivity to the internet or the wider world, and all of a sudden people can have smartphones and 4G data. And one of the experiences I actually genuinely had when I was with CARE in 2005 is I was with a bunch of rural farmers in Kibwezi. Kibwezi is a town that's agricultural, halfway between Mombasa and Nairobi. And I was working on a farming project where basically CARE was trying to help these farmers commercialize their crops and export them to the UK to make better money. But the thing about the meeting that stood out wasn't the discussion of the crops. It was that every single farmer had suddenly, since the last time I visited the year before, had suddenly gotten hold of a cell phone. And why that was, I mean, that doesn't sound that amazing now, but it was 2005, and my parents, who were 60 or so at that time back in Toronto, and, you know, I grew up in a well-off middle-class family. My mom was a teacher. My dad was an architect. In 2005, my parents didn't have a cell phone and didn't have any interest in getting a cell phone. And so to meet 14 farmers who were extremely poor and see them get cell phones and explain why that was so important to them really, you know, blew my mind.
And how were they charging them at that time, those cell phones? Was that the diesel genset that was in town and they had to charge for a buck a shot, like Russell was saying?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, in the Kenyan context, there's always been reasonable grid availability on the main roads. So in the marketplaces, you know, if you go into town to sell your vegetables to pick up some crop or whatever, you know, you're going to probably find the grid. And exactly as you say, people would retail a phone charge for 20 cents or whatever it was. That was the prevailing way. But my background, again, is more coming from a fascination with mobile technology and its leapfrog potential, and then financial inclusion and microfinance. And so the lucky break in my career was right at the gate of business school. I ended up working on M-Pesa, which is the now famous mobile money transfer service that Vodafone launched with Safaricom, their telco partner here in Kenya. And that product was effectively designed not for the wealthy Nairobiites to have the convenience of doing their banking from their phone, but it was for those same farmers to send money to their mother who lived, you know, 200 miles away seamlessly. And so a great product, really inspiring proposition. Back to what Russell said about my motivations on the commercial side, it's about finding a business model that would have a material positive impact on low-income consumers and ideally also the planet, but could do so in a scalable way, and scalable to me meant not reliant on grants.
So what was the transition from that, from that work with CARE, having that revelation that the farmer, everybody's got cell phones, that the telephony is leapfrogging, or the wireless, you somehow came up with the PAYGO model for these micro solar systems. How'd that come about?
Well, I did with a partner, a co-founder, and that co-founder is a guy called Nick Hughes, who was the founding guy behind M-Pesa. So my boss, effectively, as I left business school working on M-Pesa, I ended up at the GSMA. So as Russell said, I found a home for a while at the Global Trade Association representing phone companies. And it was a perfect job for me after working on M-Pesa, because as great as M-Pesa was, and as great as Kenya was, and as great as Nick was, it was like, okay, well, if that's the first business I've been associated to in the first market in this mobile telephony world, like, there's got to be a bunch of other cool stuff out there, right? And the GSMA afforded me the opportunity to kind of fly around the world, see a lot of mobile innovation, and connect with partners like the IFC at the time to say, okay, how do we do better greening of networks, again, in a way that's beneficial commercially to the carriers who are, you know, incurring massive diesel costs and diesel theft and all those problems you mentioned, Russell. That was one project that I led at the GSMA. Another one had to do with rolling up mobile money to other carriers who hadn't adopted the M-Pesa style proposition yet. And there was numbers of different ideas for how mobile phones could help society, but also ultimately build sustainable businesses. And so for Jesse Moore, age 30 or whatever I was at the time, basically I was seeing everything, meeting everybody, and getting a sense for where there might be an entrepreneurial opportunity. And so I'd actually skipped over this in my earlier remarks, but going to business school, I said, was for two reasons. Number one was to sharpen my business skills in what I thought would be a very hard path, you know, of entrepreneurship. But the second one was I wanted to try to start something. And I had a bit of a conviction that, you know, if I died, I'd regret never having tried to start a business from scratch. Not expecting I would succeed, of course, you know, knowing that entrepreneurship is a very challenging journey, but feeling I had a window of opportunity, partly afforded by scholarships like the one I got for grad school and having a supportive family, it was like worth the punt of picking up sticks and starting from scratch. So that's now 2010. And the germination of MCOPA with Nick as one of my co-founders was, how can we take M-Pesa, which fundamentally changed the game for payment collection, and being very specific and somewhat obvious about this, but you could suddenly collect 50 US cents equivalent in local shillings in real time from anybody. That was not possible before.
Yeah.
And if you, on the other side, believe that there would be IoT, Internet of Things connectivity to devices as an increasing trend, you could also very simply be thinking about a world where you could shut on or off stuff based on collecting 50 cents, which in turn meant that instead of a $200 upfront cost item, you could turn it into 50 cents a day for a year. And so that was our business plan. It was literally, we want to start a company that's going to finance things at 50 cents a day to people who can afford 50 cents a day, but not $200. And then we decided actually to get into solar panel financing. And it was partly, you know, my relationship with Russell and some others who said, we think this could work. Why don't you start with panels? Why don't you, you know, work with these partners, et cetera. So there was a lot of stewardship from a number of people, Russell and his team included, to say, okay, well, you guys go do the PayGo stuff, as it's now known, and we'll connect you with the solar lamp industry to develop these bigger products that could do charging. We eventually, you know, sold about 500,000 solar TVs. We sold several thousand solar fridges. So there was a whole, you know, bunch of stuff that we ended up doing. And over the course of a decade, we financed over 1 million homes with off-grid solar panels on that basis.
Well, and I think now maybe you're up to 3 million. Is that right? I, from your website, you have 3 million customers, $1 billion of credit deployed on their behalf. What is it? 500 digital payments processed every minute from your in your system. It's it, these are remarkable numbers. What was the allure to Africa for you? What I just you, like you said, you grew up in Toronto, went to college in North Carolina and, right. and London, and what took you to Africa?
Yeah.
I mean, I know the care was an introduction to it.
Right. Well, firstly, let's come back to those numbers in a minute, because I'm glad to say they're all woefully outdated. Things have been moving very quickly, and it's fun to see that 6 months old website updates are no longer you know, the right time scale for us. But the appeal to Africa was, I guess, when I was 18, 19 years old, wanting to work in the humanitarian sector. So graduating from UNC as an undergrad, which is a not arguably, Russell and I know the greatest university in the history of the face of the earth.
Oh, I've heard that before.
I mean, we shouldn't boast that much. This march wasn't our best march, but luckily it wasn't either for our rivals down the road. So anyway, coming out of Carolina, I was very fortunate as an undergraduate to get another scholarship, which was the Moorhead, now called the Moorhead Kane Foundation Scholarship. And part of what Moorhead Kane funds is not only the education at the University of North Carolina, but a bunch of summer experiences, which can literally take you around the world. And so from never having traveled overseas as a teenager, during my university years, I got to go very far. And I studied for a semester in South Africa, and I spent a summer both in rural Costa Rica and in Bolivia, working in very different contexts as a volunteer, and decided that that's what I wanted to do with my life. However, when I immediately left university and ended up in care, I pretty quickly realized that the solutions we were working on, by and large, didn't seem scalable, which is to say that the reliance on grant funding was not a good look for 50 years from now. Is this system going to work? As somebody said, I think it was actually in Harvard Business School, where I took an exact course once, but somebody simply said, it was a professor, he said, if something loses a penny per product or per transaction, it's, you know, it's never going to scale. But if you can make one penny, it's infinitely scalable, right? And so the importance of getting over that profitability divide really accesses or brings access to sustainable capital in the long term at scale. And so for me, it became, you know, a passion project to think about how I could apply my passion for development into a business context that would have, you know, both positive social benefit, but also economic returns.
Right, right. Let's talk about the kits or the products that you initially started with. And I don't think some of our listeners probably are not familiar with these, you know, these packages that go to these mm-hmm. To these folks. But I think, you know, you started in 2010 and you're primarily, you know, providing a panel and some lights and a battery, I presume. And then I think in around 2016, you got into also including televisions and refrigerators into the mix. And then 2020 got into smartphones. And now I think you're testing electric motorcycles, which I want to hear about. But can you just talk about that very first basic package that you started with?
Yeah, great question. So putting in the customer context, the original customer base we served was not exclusively, but by and large rural. So we're not talking about people living in the city where electricity access is more prolific, at least here in Nairobi. So rural folks who live away from the grid lines and don't have a connection to the grid, who live in a, you know, fairly modest multi-room house, would have probably a tin roof, bricks and some windows, three or four rooms. And fundamentally their biggest need, or their most primary need, I would say, is to light their house at night. And in addition, the next need is maybe a trade-off between one of two things: charging mobile phones, simpler mobile phones in the past, today smartphones, and or listening to the radio. So powering a radio is another big requirement. And then if you get through those things, you want to move to a television to watch the news and entertainment. And then a fridge is, you know, really getting there, right? Then you can store food. You can have tremendous positive impacts on productivity of particularly women in you know, this context, in terms of storage of food and the need to go to the market and everything else. So those are the fundamental needs. There's also a big demand for cooking, which we never have gotten into, and I don't think the industry yet is cracked. It's a much higher use case for energy. But the solar solution that we had in mind from the beginning was one that could provide a house with lighting, charging for those phones and radios, and eventually refrigeration. In some markets, there was a fan as well for cooling and sleeping at night. That was what we were after. And the first set of these solar kits just solved for pretty much the lighting need and the charger.
And that was about how many dollars worth of product?
Financed, it was about $200 to the customer with about $25 deposit. Kind of like if you think of a mortgage in the U.S., you know, you don't, well, unless you're in a boom time where people are doing crazy stuff, you have to put down 20% or 10% of the value of your house. And then you mortgage the rest on a monthly interval, right, for 20 years.
In our case, they're paying over the cell phone service that you talked about, right?
Correct.
And daily. you can turn them off if they don't pay up for a month. They don't have access. Right. Is that right?
Yeah. So each of the solar systems then would have a you know, depending on the size of the system, but it could be as small as an A4 sheet, like a legal sheet of paper, for a small panel, 5 watts or 3 watts or 8 watts, that would charge up a battery box with a lithium battery inside, but also in that box was a SIM card and a SIM card module. And that connectivity point allowed us to talk to the device and say, oh, turn this box on or discharge the power that's coming from the panel because they've already paid for it to work, or conversely, shut it off if they haven't. And literally in real time, when a customer sends 50 cents through M-Pesa to M-Copa, seconds later, their device turns off. It's quite magical.
That is magical. And now I presume that you don't have a lot of people that are not paying, or is that right? Or
I wouldn't say it's been easy. I mean, we have managed this very well. And if you're an investor in our company, and particularly a lender in our company, which actually Russ's former colleagues at the IFC are one of our major lenders as well, and we've got hundreds of millions of dollars from commercial lenders like the fine folks at Standard Bank in South Africa. you can appreciate that commercially speaking, their biggest concern is, are people going to pay you actually, right? You give them all these solar panels or now smartphones or EVs, and what does the repayment look like? It is the biggest challenge we face, but it's also a challenge that we have won much more often than we've lost. And, you know, life to date as a company, we're very proud to say that the loss rates that we've managed, even through COVID and other tough times, has always been right around 10% or less.
10%. Okay. Yeah.
I'd like to make an observation just from where I'm sitting about actually the transformative nature of what Jesse was doing. As Jesse was proving the PAYGO model, and yes, this is not easy, right? These are folks that have never been banked. There's no credit history to base it on. So it was all about operational thesis, about what works, how you parse out who's more likely to be a good credit risk, not based on whether they paid off credit cards that didn't exist, but based on demographic data about, is grandmother living at home, or is there two incomes, or what is the income and what is the crop, all these things. And what you were seeing at this time, right? Because this is 1.5 billion people that was previously not viewed as a touchable market for a whole range of services, banking, insurance, internet. And you had folks like Google circling, saying, aha, these guys are the Trojan horse getting into building a picture, a database picture of the lives of these folks that are a viable potential market to which we can sell internet services, we can sell insurance, all these different things that you and I take for granted. And so it was a fascinating moment where these mega industries and companies were circling around what these guys were doing on a shoestring to figure out a market, because they had a device to get in there and they had a phone bank. Jesse showed me, you know, the calling center, where if they were monitoring and saw someone wasn't making a payment on that week, it's a phone call. Hey, John, we noticed you're not using your power this week. What's going on? Well, we had a funeral we had to pay for.
Well, Russ, now Jesse's proven this model now, and you're in, I think, 5 or 6 countries, and you probably many more planned. Why haven't the majors jumped into this market if it's a $30 billion market out there and you got 2 billion people that lack access to, you know, reliable grid, or access to the grid at all, or reliable grid? Why haven't the majors said, hey, we like what Jesse's doing here?
Well, this might be a good time to kind of bring in the tough part of the story, which is that the economics of pay-as-you-go solar, at least at the time, I don't want to be too sort of prescriptive overstep my statement here, but in our experience, it was very hard to do this business profitably outside of Kenya. And in our case, we have pivoted the business towards different products, smartphones, and indeed electric two-wheelers, leaving some remaining players to still do okay in the solar category. And I think some are starting to thrive now in new ways. So bottom line is, as these guys were getting interested, a lot of our peer companies, including Mkopa, started to get on rocky commercial ground. And I wanna unpack why for a second, just so everybody understands the context. So, kind of as Russell put it, after we started, the industry, and I, it wasn't just us, there was probably 5 pioneering companies within the first year or two of what we're doing, and not necessarily copying people, just coming up, connecting the dots. You got mobile money, you get SIM cards, you get solar systems, pay-as-you-go was on people's minds. But 5 or so years later, there were dozens of companies doing this. And it was almost like every well-intentioned MBA grad who put their hand out and said, can I get $5 million to go start this company in Malawi, Senegal, Tanzania, name it, would get the chance.
Really?
Now, That's fine. And in a way, it would have been great if those strategies played out, which is to say, they went and set up in different markets or did something slightly different. But there was one problem in 2015, 2016, which was that mobile money, like M-Pesa in Kenya, didn't yet really work everywhere else. And I say that confidently because we were trying to expand from Kenya into Uganda and Ghana and Tanzania. And everywhere outside of Kenya, we failed, at least commercially. And we failed because the credit quality was worse. So that 10% number was not 10%, it was 15 or 20 or 30. And when we dug in as to why, it wasn't that the customers depreciated the proposition less or needed it less, but the challenge to get money into their phones and zip it to us in real time was really formidable. So if I take the example of a 2016 customer in Ghana who I interviewed, who was 2 hours outside of Accra, so a rural Ghanaian customer in a three-bedroom house, you know, same solution. Their biggest pain point was they didn't store value in their M-Pesa equivalent mobile phone like they do in Kenya now. Like everybody by 2016 was basically saving their balance of cash in M-Pesa, and they always had 50 cents to send you. So if you don't store value because you don't trust the system yet, you then got to go to an agent. And in his case, the agent was 2 or 3 miles away, which is actually a 50 cent cost to travel there and back on a bus or, you know, borrow a bike or whatever. And then when you get to the agent, it's 50-50 chance that agent's actually open or that they're, you know, ready to handle your transaction. So if you call that what I call payment friction, the payment friction in 2015, 2016 for people to get money into PAYGO companies was too formidable, ex-Kenya, that it was a bit of a bloodbath. So the model wasn't ready to scale. As a consequence, another thing that happened was the Kenyan market got very competitive. So a lot of these companies who'd set up in, again, Malawi, Rwanda, were like, wow, this isn't working like we thought. Maybe we should go to Kenya where payments are easier and like kind of save our bacon, right? So then you had too many companies in the same market fighting for diminishing segment of customers. And then the final thing, which is very circumstantial, but an important part of the story, is the one market in Africa, ironically, that has had extensive grid success in the last 10 years is the country I'm sitting in. So when we started Mkopa, we came here because M-Pesa was the payment rails we needed, and there was only 30% grid penetration. 10 years later, there was 70% grid penetration.
Oh, gosh.
Right? And then You've got all these startups trying to compete for the last 30%, and it was looking like a bloodbath.
How the heck did you survive? How did you survive this?
So that's exactly where we pivoted. We said, As much as we care about this category, really our origins are in payments and in making, you know, life-enhancing products affordable to low-income people. There are many other products that are on their wish list, including smartphones, including two-wheel electric bikes. And so we started in earnest in 2018, 2019, figuring what else we could do. And so, make a very long story short, smartphones has been an incredible success.
Yeah.
And, put in numbers, it took us 8 years to get to 1 million solar systems. It took us 18 months to get to our first 1 million smartphones. And we're in this year going to sell close to 2 million smartphones in 12 months.
Wow, Jesse, that's awesome.
So the acceleration is because it's a high demand product. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also that it was built on the rails of the PAYGO solar business. So we had the credit capabilities, we had the distribution capabilities, we had a bunch of capabilities that we could leverage to go into a new category. And after 2020 and COVID, and people are at home and nobody wants to touch money, what happened was mobile money really started to work in all these other places, right? So today you go back to Ghana, MTN has mobile money sorted and you can collect money from anybody. So let's bring that back around to pay-as-you-go solar. We as a company have decided to pivot and focus on this other category, and it's keeping us so busy that at the moment we don't have the capacity to do much more than that. But that doesn't mean that other companies that are still alive are starting, I hope, to thrive in markets where they can get the payments collected and there's not too many like-for-like businesses, you know, hitting them over the heads with competitive offerings. So we'll see if the Googles of the world, you know, or other energy providers come back to the table. I still think it's important for everybody to understand that pay-as-you-go solar is never going to be, like a Facebook or, like some massive valuation win. It's going to be hard yards, but it can be made profitable when people do it correctly. And I think it's only going to be easier and easier as technology advances in the right directions.
It's, we're running at the end of our time here, and what an incredible story. Congrats. I did want to ask you about the electric scooters. Is that something that you think will be part of your portfolio of products?
I do. And I hope I can say at this point of 13 years into building the business, 14 years, that I've got a little bit of pattern recognition. And I like what I see when I look at electric two-wheeler financing very much. It's a very similar, albeit 10x value proposition. So what I mean by 10x is it's 10 times more expensive to buy an electric bike as it is to buy one of those simple solar home systems. We're talking $2,000 to $3,000 finance rather than $200 to $300. But the fact that a EV two-wheeler can save considerable amount of money over time is the same thing as solar systems saving money on kerosene or diesel or whatever for your students. It's also true that, like LED lighting, people love it relative to kerosene, right? Kerosene is a very, very bad lighting source, both in terms of light output, but also the health impact. And you've got a very similar narrative when it comes to petrol bikes. People genuinely hate them. They're polluting, they're noisy. So you give somebody the chance to ride an electric bike and they're like, oh my God, this accelerates beautifully. It's like, this is a better ride, right? So we're dealing with very similar dynamics as we've seen before. And I think we bring some, not necessarily all, but we bring some of the capabilities to the equation that we need for industry success. What we're doing is partnering with great bike manufacturers. And just for clarity, these actually aren't scooters. They're full horsepower motorbikes. And the reason for that is our customers are not only driving on dirt roads, by and large, instead of nice paved roads, they're also not driving alone. They have a passenger on the back and they've probably got a goat behind the passenger and maybe, you know, some furniture. So these are, you know, cargo vehicles that are taking people from the main highways that are tarmacked and going into rural areas or going into urban slums.
Are they being built right there?
The biggest problem in the space, sort of, but one more point is the biggest challenge we see is not the demand and the financing. It's actually in the availability of good product.
Yeah.
Because the big bike OEMs are so focused on electric scooters for more developed economies that they basically haven't had the mind share yet to get to a full-fledged electric motorcycle. That is where you bring in the local startup companies, and two of which we work with closely, Rome and Ampersand. They're kind of very similar to what we were as a business, I guess, 10 years ago, in that they're pioneering the development of a very good product proposition where there's a big gap in, you know, in the supply chain.
And that's they're manufacturing right in Nairobi, aren't they?
That's right. So there are, much like solar and like smartphones, we also manufacture now about 100,000 smartphones locally a month in Kenya. And in the case of Rome and Ampersand, they both also manufacture or assemble the devices in East Africa. And that's because there are favorable sort of tax treatments if you localize the assembly and create jobs.
You know, Jesse, I love what you're doing, and congratulations, and your mission statement, your financing progress, the power to own, serving the financially excluded. And I was struck by your analyses or your surveys or whatnot that says that 4 out of the 5 people that you've served actually state that the quality of their life has increased. That's got to be hugely fulfilling to you. It sounds like the business. Yeah, it's been tough. Like you said, it's hard to make money from selling, you know, selling small things to poorer people. But how fulfilling for you? Is your heart just full of it should be pride of what you've accomplished?
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, it definitely is full, but it's not satisfied either. There's so much more to do. I mean, we're very proud to be at the scale that we're at. So we're now over 4 million customers, and we should be above 6 by the end of this year. We also are profitable. So in the last 12 months, we've turned the corner on generating profitability on the back of the scale that we've achieved. And that's going to help us raise more and more capital and continue to accelerate. But I think in the end of the day, the number you mentioned is the one that I call out as being the most, you know, important. The thing that makes me motivated to get up and do it again tomorrow is that the lion's share of our customers, well over 80%, when just asked a very simple question, has MCOPA benefited your life? They say either, you know, very, very convincingly yes, or, you know, strongly yes. And only about 0.5% of customers actually survey independently cite that we've done any damage to them. So we'd obviously love that 0.5% to be zero. But the fact that we are overwhelmingly helping people make their lives better is, you know, the point of what we do all day long.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I'm going to let you have the final words, Russ.
Jesse, great to as always, learn more every time I talk with you, keep it going. Keep it going, man. We need you at the frontier along with your competitors and compatriots. So thanks to the Imcopa team.
Thank you, guys. If I didn't say it before, Russell wrote the first recommendation letter for this company. Literally, we had nothing, and we had to go raise money. And I said, Russell, would you endorse this idea on paper and put your letterhead behind it and your signature? And he did. So he has had a meaningful part of helping us on this journey.
Good stuff. All right. Thanks. Thank you both for this.
Thanks, Ted.
This great interview.
Thanks, Ted. Thank you, guys.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.